Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We come to chapter 5 now, the second exit point from the cycle. And once again, I'm aligning these four exit points with the Four Noble Truths. So this is the second exit is aligned with the second Noble Truth. This, bhikkhus, is the Noble Truth of the cause of dukkha. The craving which causes rebirth and is bound up with pleasure and lust, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there, namely, craving for sense pleasure, craving for existence, craving for annihilation. This is the noble truth of the cause of dukkha, and this cause of dukkha is to be abandoned. Pahata Bhanti. Continuing with the theme of ways to liberate the heart from the cycles of addiction, I would like to look at a second escape point. This second exit point is related to the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, dukkha samudaya. You can come forward, Atsuko. You don't have to. There are cushions, mats there for the humans. Sometimes I feel like I'm radioactive. The front lines are always... I need to shower more often, so could easily, more likely to be the latter. Okay, everyone's settled in. So, the cause of suffering is defined by the Buddha as the quality of craving, tanha, literally thirst, or trishna in Sanskrit. So like being thirsty for water, that's what the word tanha literally means. Just as with the first noble truth, the Buddha gave a description of how this truth should be worked with, he named the task involved with a second noble truth as the cause of dukkha needs to be abandoned, relinquished, let go of. Idang dukkha samudayo aryasachang pahata banti. So the word to let go, is pahanati, that the verb of to relinquish, to let go, to abandon is a pahanati, so that is a sort of key term in this respect. The cause of dukkha is craving, that the cause should be abandoned, let go of, is probably the most common theme of Buddhist meditation, letting go. The importance of this teaching is based on the Buddha's advice on how to relate to craving and to the end and to end suffering. Furthermore, to highlight this as the centerpiece of his Dhamma instruction, he repeatedly stated, "What I describe now as formally is dukkha and the ending of dukkha," and that's a teaching or a phrase, a comment that the Buddha makes many times in the teachings, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, in the section 22, in the, also section 44, many places. So it's been mentioned before in these readings, but one of the things that is a sort of characteristic, particularly of the Southern Buddhist school, is the Buddha's understatement. He's not glamorizing the goal of the holy life. He's not saying happiness forever, or you know, you'll be you'll experience transcendent bliss for eternity, or this is the realization of the infinite absolute. And such like. He doesn't use that kind of, occasionally he does, but mostly he doesn't use that kind of glamorizing language, or that he doesn't sort of talk things up. It's a very understated, it's more of a kind of a sparrow Dhamma rather than a peacock Dhamma. You know, it's kind of not a sort of bright and colorful promise, but rather it's understated and so. there are places where, you know, the Buddha says, you know, this is the highest human say potential that we have, but it's more, it's understated, the whole tone is deliberately understated, and it's pointing to the work that needs to be done, rather than look at the rewards you're going to get if you if you carry this out. You know, look at what this, look at what is there at the end of the at the end of the path, but rather this is what you need to do to stay on the path and to travel to the end of it. So that, and that's a very strong characteristic of the Southern Buddhist tradition and the Pali canon generally. And so that that can be a bit disappointing, or maybe we like teachings that are a bit more inspiring, or sort of have that kind of quality of promise, or you know, that, brightening or gladdening. But I feel over the years I realized it was a very deliberate approach. The Buddha's quite consciously understating things, and so that you're not drawn into it by a by being sort of dazzled by, you know, happiness forever, or you know, infinite bliss for eternity, but rather it's the attention goes on, well, yes, those ideas are nice, but right now you can use the mats and the cushions are for the humans, please. There we'll keep looking at you till you come and sit on the cushion. So it's very deliberately understated, and so that the attention goes on to the work that needs to be done, rather than being sort of say taken up with the aspect of promise. And we've been talking quite a bit about bhavatanna vipavatanna, because it's so easy for that that aspiration, or sort of leaning towards a bright and shiny promise, that you don't notice where your feet are, you trip over your own feet, or you take a wrong turning, you get caught up in the becoming urge of that promise over there, that you don't notice of what you need to do in order to stay on track and make the progress that's really going to make a difference. So that's a very say helpful to understand. That's a very deliberate say style of teaching, a kind of method of pedagogical to use a very long word. It's a kind of pedagogical style that the Buddha uses very deliberately, so why he also wouldn't, when people ask what happens to an enlightened being at the death of the body, the Buddha just wouldn't speak about that. He said, you know, that people try to persuade him to talk about these sort of descriptions of, you know, ultimate reality and such like, and he would just say, you know, I teach suffering and the ending of suffering. So, which can be a bit of a disappointment. But over time, you see, what it does, it helps to undercut that becoming urge and the tendency to focus on a beautiful, brilliant, inspiring ideal, but not be carrying out the necessary work in order for that ideal to be actualized. So he was a very pragmatic teacher, very practical, and so that his approach was pragmatic rather than idealistic, I would say. When Ajahn Sumedho was a novice in Thailand more than 50 years ago, he studied and contemplated the Four Noble Truths very deeply, as he has done ever since. At that time, he was particularly helped by Venerable Nyanatiloka's book, The Word of the Buddha, which was published many, many decades ago. And it's just a collection of the essential teachings from the Pali Canon, very, very little commentary at all. It's mostly just the sutta quotations about the Four Noble Truths, the Word of the Buddha. It became clear, and he read it 80 times. It was the only book he had, apparently. He's living in a hut in this little monastery in Nong Khai, a meditation monastery. Mostly they practiced the Mahasisayad or meditation technique, Wat Nuom Pranao, I think it was called, in Nong Khai. And he had this one book and he read it 80 times, 80, not 18, 80 times. So he really took it in. also he had a lot of insight during that time, just using that, and he realized that this was all he in terms of information. After he'd been studying for years at the University of Washington, University of California in Berkeley, and had master's degree in Asian history and such like, he said, okay, this is all you need to know. That was this sense of this information is as much information as really required. And spent that year literally in his hut practicing with these essential teachings. It became clear to the young novice Sumato, before he was a bhikkhu, he was a samanera for that year, and then his bhikkhu ordination was at the end of that first year in Nongkai. It became clear to the young novice Sumato that letting go, quote unquote, was the central task of Dhamma practice, so he made a great emphasis on this over the subsequent years then, and also over the subsequent years of his training. As Ajahn Sumato has a natural ability to visualize, he would sometimes write these words in his imagination, let go, let go, let go, in big green letters with red flashing lights around them. And I have vague memories of him describing the colors, the color scheme. I couldn't, you have to ask him when you get a chance, but I couldn't swear that it's exactly big green letters with red flashing lights, but that was how I remembered him talking about it. So he was literally sort of paint those in his inner sphere, let go, let go, let go, like with sort of neon lights around to remind him what needed to be done. I don't have that kind of an ability, but I'm more verbal than visual, but he has a great skill at visualization. He can adjust colors. So he would just fill his mind with like purple or pink and say, no, pink, that pink's a bit too yellowish. You need to have a more purple pink. You can adjust the colors, the color mix. Just amazing to me. he has that ability. The Buddha underscored the importance of letting go in the shorter discourse on the destruction of craving, the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta I mentioned before. And this is the key passage at the beginning of that sutta on this principle. And this is the god Indra, Sakha, speaking to the Buddha, asking this question. Venerable Sir, how in brief is a bhikkhu liberated through the ending of craving? One who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, and is foremost among gods and humans. The Buddha replies, here, ruler of the gods, it's when a bhikkhu has heard nothing is worth holding on to, and bhikkhu in this term means sort of a meditator, spiritual practitioner, it's a more sort of generalized term for a spiritual aspirant. It's when a bhikkhu has heard nothing is worth holding on to. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya. When a bhikkhu has heard that nothing is worth holding on to, they directly know all things. Directly knowing all things, they completely understand all things. Having completely understood all things, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they abide contemplating impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and letting go in those feelings. And that's anicca, and then viraga, nirodha, vosagga. Vosagga is what translated as letting go, it also means to abandon or to relinquish, vosagga. So they abide contemplating impermanence, anicca, dispassion, viraga, cessation, nirodha, and letting go, vosagga, in those teachings. Contemplating thus, they don't grasp at anything in the world. Not grasping, they are not agitated. Not being agitated, they personally realize nibbana. They understand, rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming into any state of existence. And the astute amongst you, and those who were here yesterday, will recognize that that's got a close connection with that passage from the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of the elements about a sage at peace who is not born, does not age, does not die, they are not shaken, they are not agitated, for there is nothing present in them by which they might be born. Not being born, how could they age? Not aging, how could they die? Not dying, how could they be shaken? Not being shaken, how should they be agitated? So that that quality of inner stillness, free the heart, free of grasping, there isn't that agitation or that kind of is a way of representing a profound stability. The heart is unshakable. The akupa is unshakable. Kupa is to be shaken. Akupa is to be unshaken. Akupa me vimuti, unshakable is my deliverance. Also, mention, this is also the passage I was referring to, nothing is worth holding on to, sabedama nalang abhinivesaya, that I was mentioning about the Vimalakirti Sutra the other day, about how that there's a strange relationship between that Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta and the Vimalakirti Sutra. So the Vimalakirti Sutra is a famous teaching from the northern Buddhist school. And not only is that that passage sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya that comes from or is the same phrase as appears in this sutta, but also Indra appears in the Chakra is the name that's used in the Vimalakirti Sutra, the Saka in Pali, Chakra in Sanskrit. And I thought I'd just read out this particular passage where that phrase appears. Also, it's the Buddha uses the nickname for Saka, which is Kosya, which literally means the owl, like the bird that flies at night time and catches mice. So his nickname was Kosya, and that is also used in the Vimalakirti Sutra. Chakra, the nickname Kosika, Kosika is used to refer to, the Buddha talks to Chakra, or I think that the Chakra appears in the sutra, and is used. That nickname is used for Chakra, and there's other parallels as well. There's probably room for a PhD. Anyone wants to Buddhist have a at least write an article, or probably get a PhD out of the relationship between the shorter discourse on the destruction of craving and on the Vimalakirti Sutra. So this is called this is the beginning of chapter 6, the inconceivable liberation. And as I mentioned, Venerable Sariputta is what they call a fall guy. He's made fun of over and over again as a sort of archetype of the arahants who are being kind of made fun of throughout this sutra. That arahantship is being looked upon as a bit somewhat small-minded, which is from the southern Buddhist tradition the perspective is totally weird, but it's got a bit of a defamatory tone to the Vimalakirti Sutra. It's called mythic defamation, defamation, not deformation, like defaming or kind of making fun of or putting down. As the Buddha often does with the Brahmins, the northern Buddhists tended to do with the southern Buddhists. I realize I'm being recorded, but it's well attested and a much recognized fact. So Venerable Sariputta has come with a group of monks. They've been invited to have a meal offering at Vimalakirti's home. Vimalakirti is a householder. When he arrives at the home, thereupon the Venerable Sariputta had this thought. Sariputra had the thought, there is not even a single chair in this house. Where are these disciples and bodhisattvas going to sit? The Lichavi Vimalakirti read the thought of the Venerable Sariputra and said, Reverend Sariputra, did you come here for the sake of the Dharma, or did you come here for the sake of a chair? So there's also when he's worried about that it's getting towards noon, and this is he hasn't offered the food yet. It's getting towards noon. Yeah, when's the layman going to offer the food? The Sangha are going to go hungry. And Venerable Shariputra, did you come here for food or did you come here for the Dharma? And of course the sun stops. For, I think if I remember the sutra correctly, the sun stops moving for long enough for the Sangha to comfortably have their meal before noon arrives. So just sort of the little kind of nuance of the sutra, like, you don't have to worry, Venerable. Yeah, the sun happens to have stopped today. Look, the shadow is still not at noon. So anyway, this is about chairs. Not to get too distracted. Okay. Sariputra replied, I came for the sake of the Dharma, not for the sake of a chair. Vimalakirti continued, Reverend Sariputra, he who is interested in the Dharma is not interested even in his own body, much less in a chair. Reverend Sariputra, he who is interested in the Dharma has no interest in matter, sensation, intellect, motivation, or consciousness, so rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. He has no interest in these aggregates, or in the elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, or in the sense media, i.e. nose, tongue, body, mind. Interested in the Dharma, he has no interest in the realm of desire, the realm of matter, or the immaterial realm, the rupa loka or arupa loka. Interested in the Dharma, he is not interested in attachment to the Buddha, attachment to the Dharma, attachment to the Sangha. Reverend Sariputra, he who is interested in the Dharma, is not interested in recognizing suffering, in abandoning its origination, realizing its cessation, or practicing the path. So the Four Noble Truths. Why? The Dharma is ultimately without formulation and without verbalization. Who verbalizes suffering should be recognized, origination should be eliminated, cessation should be realized, the path should be practiced, is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in verbalization. So he's setting a high bar here, a high standard. Reverend Sariputra, the Dharma is calm and peaceful. Those who are engaged in production and destruction are not interested in the Dharma, are not interested in solitude, but are interested in production and destruction. Furthermore, Reverend Sariputra, the Dharma is without taint and free of defilement. He who is attached to anything, even to liberation, is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in the taint of desire. The Dharma is not an object. He who pursues objects is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in objects. The Dharma is without acceptance or rejection. He who holds onto things or lets go of things is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in holding on and letting go. The Dharma is not a secure refuge. He who enjoys a secure refuge is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in a secure refuge. The Dharma is without sign. He whose consciousness pursues signs is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in signs. The Dharma is not a society. He who seeks to associate with the Dharma is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in association. The Dharma is not a sight, a sound, a category, or an idea. He who is involved in sights, sounds, categories, and ideas is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in sights, sounds, categories, and ideas. Reverend Sariputra, the Dharma is free of compounded things and uncompounded things. He who adheres to compounded things and uncompounded things is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in adhering to compounded things and uncompounded things. Thereupon, Reverend Sariputra, if you are interested in the Dharma, you should take no interest in anything. When Vimalakirti had spoken this discourse, 500 gods obtained the purity of the Dharma eye in viewing all things. So that phrase, if you are interested in the Dharma, you should take no interest in anything, that is sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya. That's the Sanskrit version of that. So, and this translation was by Robert Thurman, and if I remember correctly, I checked with him, with Robert Thurman and himself, whether that was the Sanskrit of that Pali phrase. So I did check up on that. So it's, you know, essentially let go of everything, let go of concepts of everything, even of the conditioned and the unconditioned, and the Four Noble Truths as ideas or as words. That it's very skillful teaching in its own right. But it is interesting how the content of that is reflected in the this very wonderful teaching from the Middle Length Discourses. This is Sutta 37, if you want to look it up, when the Buddha says, when you've heard, nothing is worth adhering to. That's Bhikkhu Bodhi's and Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's translation. You directly know everything. Having directly known everything, you understand everything. Having understood everything, whatever you feel, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral, the mind abides contemplating impermanence in those feelings, contemplating fading away, viraga, contemplating cessation, nirodha, and relinquishment, bodhisattva. And so that, as I mentioned a few days ago, Ajahn Buddhadasa said, this is the, you can sum up the entirety of the Buddha's teaching in those four words, sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya. He said that many times, that the whole of the entire Buddha's teaching, you can sum up, don't cling to anything. And then I had the chance to spend a couple of weeks at Suwon-mok in 1988, and he said, he was talking about that phrase, he said, actually I said that you can summarize the whole Buddha's teaching in four words, you can take it down to three if you really try. And then the three words are, in English, don't be selfish. So you can get it down to three words. That's the essence of it. So there's a lot there. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Don't be shy. Yes.
Ajahn, how helpful do you think that kind of teaching is in terms of the Vimalakirti Sutta, where, you know, because it says things like, you know, things like safe refuge, for instance, and obviously on the kind of way to being, you know, having completely let go of everything, is quite helpful to have like supporting conditions, maybe the audience is a bit more therapeutic, so maybe they need that, but for the average, you know, average practitioner,
they like a chair.
Yeah, like a chair, you know, more clothes. So,
it's a good question. I think that that kind of sutra, and also I'm reminded of the Heart Sutra. They're giving a particular message to not be. To not let the mind be taken up with unconscious kinds of attachments. So it's like things that we would generally think of as sort of good, and oh, that should be held on to, like the Four Noble Truths, or taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. It's saying, well, make sure that it's not just the idea of it, or just the words of it, or just the form of the structure of it, that notice how easily the mind attaches to the forms. And in the Heart Sutra it says there is... form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is not separate from emptiness, emptiness is not separate from form, and so too with feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And then it says, there is no suffering, no origination, no cessation, and no way. And there's no understanding and no attaining, there is nothing to be attained. And so that it's sort of emptying everything out, highlighting that as a perspective, because the mind easily just takes the idea of liberation, or takes the idea of letting go, or the path, and we hang on to the idea and we're not actualizing it. So that it's like a skillful means. One of the interesting things with the Heart Sutra also the Bodhisattva vows, speaking again about the northern tradition, that I've stayed in quite a lot of different monasteries and centers, Zen centers and Tibetan, Chinese, Vietnamese places, and very, very often in the daily puja, you have both the Heart Sutra being recited, usually in Chinese or Japanese or Tibetan and so on, but you have the Heart Sutra and the Bodhisattva vows. And there's a very interesting sutra in the Chinese where it points out how the Bodhisattva vows are deliberate extensions of the Four Noble Truths. That each of the four Bodhisattva vows is like a taking each of the Four Noble Truths and extending it out to relate not just to this being and this mind, but to all beings. So, like, there is dukkha, is all beings are experiencing suffering. You know, if afflictions are limitless, or living beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. It's the first Bodhisattva vow. And then afflictions are limitless, I vow to cut them all off. So that's like, this is the cause of dukkha, is afflictions. And then the truths number 3 and 4 are switched around. So in the Bodhisattva vows you have Dharma doors are limitless, I vow to enter them all, is the Eightfold Path. And then the Buddha way is supreme, I vow to accomplish it. That's the equivalent of the third noble truth, the Dukkha Nirodha is to be realized. So, and you have those two side by side in the puja. So there is no suffering, no origination, no cessation, and no way. And then all beings are suffering. Am I going to save them all? You know, afflictions are limitless. Not only are there afflictions, they're limitless, they're uncountable. So it's sort of, one says, you know, these Four Noble Truths, they're empty, don't attach them. And the others are, these Four Noble Truths, they apply to all beings as much as to your... to yourself, just as to one individual. And so, to me, it's a different skillful means, different upaya. You know the word upaya? It's the different upayas of taking the Four Noble Truths and both seeing that they are, and like Lumpo Someda would say, they're not absolute truths, they're relative truths. That's why they're called noble. They're relative truths that lead to liberation. That's why they're called noble rather than absolute truths. They're conditioned and formed. They are conventional truths, but they're noble in that if they're followed and developed, then they lead to realization of the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, and that which is unconditioned. So that it's a way of taking the Four Noble Truths and recognizing that yes. They're relative truths. They're not absolutes, but also they don't need to be just confined to this one life. That they're to recollect that these principles can be applied to a much broader sphere, a much broader range of the universe than just this one life. So that it's like a skillful means of reflecting on the Four Noble Truths as both being empty and being universal. So it's like a skillful way of taking the contemplation of those truths and working with them. Yes?
Would then be then the same true for what you said, that you should not be interested in anything? Because when I hear that, my little ego goes, I'm a curious creature, and I like to explore things, so you know, you should not be interested in anything. It feels like it could just switch off, and just don't, you know. So is it the same thing of, not being interested in a sense of understanding that is, anything will not bring freedom from suffering, but can be used as skillful means.
Yeah, I would. I somewhat question Robert Thurman. I mean, he's a much far more accomplished scholar than me, but I mean, like orders of magnitude. But I did question his translation, the wording he uses, because so sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya, that is. Abhinivesaya is like a relishing or taking hold of, or there's a sort of that interest isn't just paying attention to or the chanda interest, but there's a that relishing is a good word, because it's got that sort of tensing or the mind looking at the world of things. I mean, I also am very interested in many things. I'm sure I've got far more books in my living place than you have. I haven't got quite as many as the library, but my mind appreciates things and interested in lots of different things. But that It's that relishing of, I will be incomplete if I don't have this information, or that I need to know about X, or I want to be I want to have this, so that, in essence, recognizing things like, and also in that the way the phrase is formed, it is kind of, maybe Robert Thurman did it on purpose, but he deliberately says, if you are interested in the Dharma, you should take no interest in anything. So also he says, you know, the Dharma is not an object. So that if you're interested in the Dharma, like if you're paying, if that's what you're giving your attention to, then you should take no interest in anything. You know, so that there, it's like that the, if the mind is endeavoring to pay full attention or be fully aware of its fundamental nature, then notice how the attention drifts from that and looks for gratification or completion in the world of things. And so that is, and it's another way of saying sabbe sankhara dukkha, you know, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory. But it doesn't mean that we sort of discard or dismiss or go numb in the face of the world of things. I mean, that's what the Buddha said, you know, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory. But he spent 45 years after his enlightenment juggling the world of conditioned things, taking action, speaking, going different places, relating to different people. But it's that the attitude of relating to the world of things, participating in the world of things and actions and information, activity, but without that grasping attitude, or without that sense that this thing is going to complete me, or I've got to get rid of this thing, otherwise I will be burdened. It's like, and I feel also that's the touching of the earth at the Buddha's enlightenment. That is a gesture of being of humility and being open to the world of things, and saying that the world of things is totally acceptable. How could it really limit the reality of the Dhamma? So it doesn't have to be kept at bay, or doesn't have to be rejected or dismissed. And so that symbol can be read in different ways. But I feel that's it's a way of representing that quality of attunement to the world of things without being limited or defined by the world of things. So, to carry on. Oh, sorry, yes.
Could be that Buddha was saying let go of everything, but to someone that had the conditionality, just by saying that word, to let go, and not like normally, like we should not let go of practice or not. So it's just to that condition only.
Yeah, so Lumpo Cha used to speak about this very often. He said, because people would ask that same question very regularly, say, so should we, you know, let go of the Dhamma and the Vinaya, and you know, how do we do anything? And he'll say, well, to let go doesn't mean to not do anything. And he would usually pick up something. Often it was like a flashlight, or if you need a box of tissues, I mean, just using this example, then you can, you know, pick it up. You hold it. When you don't need to hold it anymore, then you put it down. So the picking up and holding, there's no problem with that. If you need to pick something up, you take hold of it, you use it, and then when you don't need it anymore, you put it down. And he would use it like a flashlight or a glass of water, and say, so it's holding without learning how to hold without grasping. So letting go doesn't mean never holding anything, but it means not saying, you know, this is my glass of water. This belongs to me. And I'm going to keep it. You know. So that now it's me. I've kept that bit. So that it's that essentially that balance of both being the transcendent aspect of the mind that is seeing that, you know, all things are empty, all things are unsatisfactory, but also the aspect of mind that's attuned to the conditioned world that is relating to the people and things, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, in a skillful and mindful way. And a few days ago, I think I mentioned that exchange between Lumpur Cha and the young Ajahn Sumedho, and he said one day, you know, Sumedho, you must be confused. And you know, why is that, Lumpur? I said, well, because the Dhamma is all about letting go, but the Vinaya is all about holding on. Like, do this, don't do that. This is the right way to sit, the right way to fold your sitting cloth, the right way to pick up your yam and carry it around and so on. And there's the wrong way to do things. And so the young Ajahn Sumedho said, yes, Lumpur, that's right. It is confusing. And he thought Lumpur was going to give like an extensive Dhamma talk about how to understand that. But all that Lumpur Cha said was, when you figure out how those work together, you'll be fine. So that the Dhamma is the transcendent side, and the Vinaya is the Lokiya, the worldly side, and they work together. It's the Dhamma Vinaya is the legacy that we have inherited, and so that is in many respects is the middle way, is how that recognizing the conventional truth and ultimate truth, how they samuti satya and paramatta satya, how they work together. That's our daily practice.
Practically, if there is no mindfulness, no concentration, not the right condition, cannot be done.
Then we won't let go.
So, and sometimes if someone is attached to, for example, the teacher, sometimes it's useful for him in one way.
It can be, but it depends. Like anything, it's like if the weather's cold, it's good to be attached to your hat. Otherwise, you'll get a cold head. You know, if you lose your hat, your head will get cold. It's kind of yes. There's a certain, but then if you've lost your hat and you don't know where it is, okay, well that's not my hat anymore. Let's see if I can find another one, and so that you have to. Recognize that, yeah, the things that we like to own or draw or have around, they aren't ultimately under our control, and so that the more that attachment is based on grasping and clinging, then it'll produce suffering. If the attachment is without grasping, it's like people would. I'm not trying to boast, but people would say when Lumpur Sumedho wasn't living here, he'd back in Thailand and say, "Oh, do you miss Lumpur?" And I say, "No." "Oh, don't you care about him?" "Yeah, I care about him greatly. He's my teacher, and I revere him and love him profoundly." "Well, don't you miss him?" "No." Sometimes I'm not sort of making fun of people or trying to put anyone on the spot. I said that to him, but it's like. You can love someone and appreciate them and revere them as a teacher, but not be possessive of them. It was great that Lumpur has come to visit here, and come to stay here and not just be visiting, to be living here. It's fantastic. But this year he's aiming to be away for about 6 months, and so I won't miss him when he's not here.
But my question was that if Venerable the Buddha maybe could have like just said to someone, and this person, oh, let go of the body, this person let go of the body, let go of the mind, let go of the mind, you know, and just uses the suttas, techniques of liberating people's heart. And we read the sutta, and maybe it's not for
all of us. No, I mean, sometimes the Buddha gives a teaching, and like the very first discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, he said the bhikkhus were not delighted at the Blessed One's words. Like they disagree. Like that's sutta number one in this in the Majjhima. They did not like to hear what the Buddha said. So yes, the teaching, someone can say let go, and somebody can hear that and go, yes, wow, of course, and then let go of everything, and so become an arahant on the spot. So sometimes that does occur in the teachings. But the person has to have the barometer and have to sort of be pre-cooked, you know, like just add hot water and serve. You know. The kind of, if they're not pre-cooked, then it's like, let go. Who are you to tell me to let go? I'm not holding on to anything. Get out of here. Like, and then yeah, that's they carry on in their own sweet way. So it depends on the potential of the person who's listening. Okay, so to continue. And the next section is called Feeling Conditions Craving, Exile from the Garden. When we look at the links of dependent origination, the first four of these, ignorance, formations, consciousness, mind and body, can be seen to set up the subject-object duality, the feeling of me and the world, quote-unquote. The next three, the six sense spheres, sense contact and feeling, salayatana, passa, vedana, describe the arising of a particular sense event, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, or thinking something in particular. This brings us to the realm of feeling, vedana, or sensation. So salayatana, sal means six, ayatana is oftentimes. So the six sense spheres or sense bases. So ayatana is another word you can't really completely translate into English, but it's a very helpful, very useful word. So when in the Udana, the book of the eighth chapter of the Udana, the first sutta, the way to the beyond, I think. No, that's the eighth chapter, the. What's it called? Pakati Village? Anyway, chapter 8 of Udana, where it says, there is that ayatana, where there is no sun, no moon, no stars, no coming, no going, no standing still, no dying, no reappearance, and so on and so forth. So that, the word where it says there is that sphere of being or that realm, ayatana is the word that's used there. So it can even refer to a transcendent. The word ayatana can refer to a transcendent quality. So that it's not just related to conditioned things, but there is that in that sutta in the Udana, there is that ayatana, that sphere of being or that dimension wherein there is no coming, no going, no standing still. So that's salayatana, the six sense spheres, so that's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. The six sense bases are ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. When things have reached this stage, it can still be very simple. The mind can still be clear and peaceful while there is contact and feeling. Consider enlightened beings like the Buddha. They see, they hear, they smell, they taste, they touch, they feel. That realm of perception and feeling can be completely free of suffering and difficulty. And in the next chapter also, I'll talk about that as represented by one of the teachings in the a very helpful sutta to get to know in the Book of the Tens, in the numerical discourses, sutta number 53, 58. Let's see, what is it? Sutta number, Book of the Tens, Sutta 58. So we'll get to that in the next chapter, but where it talks about how feeling doesn't have to condition craving. So this next section is, I would put under the category of speculative. This is Amaro joining up the dots. The great tradition of randomly joining up dots in religious textual exploration. And so so please take this with as much salt as you like, if salt is part of your diet. But anyway, I'll go through this for people's contemplation. When I first began to look closely into Paticca Samuppada, I was confounded by a number of its mysteries. I couldn't work out what the whole pattern was referring to. With a vague memory in mind and intrigued by how ignorance, or innocence, desire and suffering seemed to be themes in common, I searched out a copy of the Bible and found in the first chapter of Genesis a mythical Judaic version of the Paticca Samuppada. Again, this is not canonical or definitive take on things, but it's a, particularly for people who come from a Judeo-Christian conditioned background, this might be interesting, valuable. One can reflect that this process, described so thoroughly in the Pali Canon, is related to that primal theme of the Bible. The realm of feeling is like life in the Garden of Eden. It can be very pleasant and very simple. The trouble begins when tanha shows up. That's the serpent. What dependent origination describes is the emergence of suffering out of perfection, the emergence of pain and difficulty out of that which is pure and whole. So I was talking about how, with say, Venerable Ajahn Mun would say, you know, that everything has a father and mother, and the father and mother of ignorance is the primal mind. Titi Bhutang. So, the way the King James Version of the Bible begins is, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," quote unquote. But I feel that what is meant is more along the lines of, it is out of God, out of perfect unity, ultimate reality, that division emerges. I should explain a little how I arrived at this. I found that this phrase, "in the beginning," in reflective experience, suggested to me when a pattern appears, when the experience of a thing begins, there emerges self and other, subject and object, this and that. Heaven, quote unquote, in this respect, represents that which is elsewhere. Earth, quote unquote, that which is here. That division between here and there, subject and object, occurs when something begins and is known, when a world comes into being. After the heavens and the earth are created, there are a series of images, beginning with, "and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters," quote unquote. We can look at this part of the process as the arrival of consciousness. This consciousness is established in relationship to the world, just as vijnana and namarupa lean upon each other and form a reciprocal relationship. That means affecting each other or conditioning each other. That vijnana-namarupa vortex mentioned earlier. In this world, the land and the waters are created, as well as all of the animals and creatures. This we can see as signifying the development of materiality and mentality, bodies and minds, this leading on to Salayatana, the six sense spheres and their functions, the different ways of perceiving the world and living and of living life, different ways of being. This is comparable to sense contact, pasa. Then there's the arising of humanity, Adam and Eve, man and woman, and their life together in the garden. This takes us up to the point of sensation, or feeling, which is unself-conscious. So again, this is all very speculative, tentative, and up for reflection, consideration, so please don't take this as anything definitive, but just how these patterns took shape. And so to continue. Now, it is at this turn that the serpent comes along, and it represents, understandably enough, temptation or desire, tanha. Desire comes along and says, "Here's the tree of knowledge standing right in the middle of the garden. You could help yourself. There is more to life than just being in the garden like this, you know." The snake has its charms, and soon desire turns into clinging as Eve and Adam eat the fruit of the tree. From this follows becoming. As knowledge and self-consciousness arise, then comes rebirth, Suddenly Adam and Eve realize that they are naked. There's the shock of birth as the master appears on the scene. Adam, where are you? That's the appearance in the, when God shows up in the garden and starts looking for his creations. Adam, where are you? Oh God. Pun intended. The natural consequence of the moment of birth, when Adam and Eve are discovered, is represented as God's judgment and punishment he puts upon them. So they find themselves driven out of Eden, exiled from the garden, sensitive, open, separated, and subject to all kinds of suffering. They are born into the world feeling heat and cold, hunger, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, quote unquote. Or, to paraphrase Genesis chapter 3, all the days of your lives you will toil with sweat and bring forth children in pain. So that's my little thesis on Genesis and the Paticca Samuppada. So please ignore if that's confusing or makes or you feel that's totally erroneous or unhelpful. But it's basically the relationship between ignorance, craving, and dukkha. I think it's a mythological representation of the same that I would suggest. In the realm of feeling, there can be a lot of clarity and wisdom. There's the body and the life of the senses, and then the experience of feeling, pleasant, painful, or neutral. That on its own doesn't cause any difficulty at all. It's very simple, and the heart can be completely awake and at peace with it. But the stronger the influence of ignorance, not seeing clearly, the lack of wisdom, the lack of mindfulness, the more that the mind will believe in those feelings of liking, disliking, and neutral feeling, and will tend to be intoxicated by them. If there is a lack of mindfulness and wisdom, then, when there is a feeling of dislike, it turns easily into, I hate it, I can't stand it, I've got to get away from this. Similarly, if it's an experience of liking, and if there is a lack of mindfulness and wisdom, then the liking turns into, ooh, this is great, I want this, I've got to have this, and the mind chases after that desire object. Any questions, thoughts? Don't be shy. Okay, very good. Once the mind crosses that bridge between feeling and craving, between Vedana and Tanha, then it becomes more and more difficult to turn back. Maybe a better image is getting onto a train. While you're standing on the platform at the station, you can still decide where you want to go, which train you want to board, to Paris or Milan. Or maybe we're happy just staying here on the platform. But once we get on that train and it starts to move, we follow that desire and there's an engagement with that object. So standing on the platform is equivalent to the Vedana domain. So once we've got on the train and it starts to move, we follow that desire and there is an engagement with that object. While the train is still going slowly, maybe you could force the door open and jump out, although you would get some bumps and bruises. But once the train is up to full speed, you can't jump off. That is jati, birth. Also, this is a bit of an outdated example because you can't open train doors once the train's moving nowadays. But back in the old days, those of us who remember when you could open a train door and fall out, that applies. But nowadays, most trains in most countries, you can't open the doors. I think maybe in Thailand, the trains are so old, you can still easily open the doors and fall out. So that Thailand is famous for its ancient train carriages. But they still work, but they're old. So, that is jati, birth. So the easiest thing to do is to be mindful while you're still standing on the platform. Do I want to get on this train or do I not? If we develop mindfulness of feeling, being aware of the experience of liking, disliking, and of neutral feeling, then this can make life much simpler. We recognize that we can like something without wanting it, or we can dislike something without hating it, or we can have neutral feelings towards something without nursing any opinion at all about it. In that way, we give ourselves a great deal of freedom in life. Once we have plucked that fruit from the tree, it cannot be put back on the branch, so we become limited by the results of that act. Our freedom is lost. It's one of the things that we often don't realize is that we don't have to have opinions. And so this is, I found particularly here in the UK as well, but particularly living in America, which I've lived there for 15 years or so, and visiting for longer still, that people would often ask you, well, what do you think about George Bush? And I usually say, I don't think about George Bush. But you must have an opinion. I said, well, why must I? I don't think about it. Well, you know. And so sometimes it's we forget that we can just say, what do you feel about Mahayana Buddhism? He said, well, I don't feel anything about it. Well, you must feel something. Well, no, I mustn't. Or, you know, whatever it might be in a family circle, the things that people are excited about or upset about, that oftentimes when people say, well, what do you think about this? Or what do you feel about that? It's quite legal to say, I don't think about it. I mean, it shouldn't be lying, obviously. Don't lie. But if you don't have any feelings or an opinion, it's totally okay to say, I don't have an opinion. And it's interesting how many and various things, not just politics, but all sorts of areas of life, and I say, oh, well, I don't really have an opinion about that. So, or what's your favourite food? You say, the food that's in my bowl. That's my, you know, that's much more interesting than the food that's in Venerable Dhamma Vijaya's bowl. that's my favourite food, is the food that I'm eating. So, and they go, but no, but what's your favourite food? I don't have a favourite. Why? You know, well, you must have. Well, no, I mustn't. And just not to be swept up by people's expectations, but not to be sort of too clever. I mean, it's easy to be a bit too clever, but just to recognise that you have the space not to have an opinion about things. And so this reflection on standing on the platform and whether you get on a thing, because sometimes people just they're just looking for a sense of interaction. I mean, not to be sort of cold and sort of rigid or remote, but sometimes people, they just want to engage with you and sort of get something going. But we don't have to be part of that. You don't have to join in with that. Because you can find yourself, sometimes you just say, blue. They say, well, red's actually much better. I really like red. Red is really, really much better. Don't you think? Red's got a lot going for it. Yeah, red's okay. But really, I prefer blue. It's like, okay. If you see what I mean, the kind of people just put things out, looking for some kind of a comment or a reaction or a response. And really what they want is just to feel like they are, they exist. It's a sort of, if you're familiar with that book, I'm Okay, You're Okay, by Eric Byrne, was it? Eric Byrne, I'm Okay, You're Okay. It's quite okay to communicate, just to be sort of friendly and open to people. But oftentimes, I don't know about all of you, but I would over and over again find myself in some kind of discussion. I don't really care about this. I'm not really interested. How do I get involved in this? You know, like someone say, you know, so what football team do you support? That's not something I think about. Oh, come on! Now, when you were young, what was your football team? Yes, got no interest at all for you, but you find yourself sort of drawn into it. And you say, well, you know, Crystal Palace, they got this weird rivalry with Brighton. Yeah, did you know that? No, I didn't. You know, it's quite okay, but it's like, why? You're not particularly interested in the whole field. But it's really just a way of, here we are together, let's spend some time in each other's company, and we're just using the football teams and their interrelationship.
It may have been Nick.
It wasn't.
Oh, someone different.
Someone different. So, but it's often just a way of just I'm okay, you're okay. Am I really okay? Yeah, you're okay. Do you think I'm okay? Yeah, I think you're okay too. So we're both okay. Okay, that's good. And that's the sort of the undercurrent. That's all you're saying, really. But on the surface level, you're talking about what's on the television or political figures or all kinds of stuff. So just being mindful of those kind of dynamics and realizing that I don't have to join in, or I don't have to. I'm not being unkind if I'm not participating in the opinion exchange. it's so easy to be drawn into that unconsciously. So it's gone past 7 o'clock again. The time has gone by. So let's just leave it there for now. Yes.
Andamayam dhamma vadakataya sadhu karanda dhammase
sadhu sadhu.